Hello, friend. Welcome back to Crazy Money. I hope you're having a wonderful day. And if not, just remind yourself, today's a great day to be alive. You got to learn it. You got to know it. You got to live it. That's what it's all about. My guest this week is a very fun conversationalist. His name is Gary Stevenson, and he's the author of a new memoir called The Trading Game, A Confession. Gary, as you will no doubt deduce very quickly from his distinct accent, grew up in a tough working class neighborhood in East London. Despite setbacks in high school, having to do with the distribution of illicit substances, Gary's gift for mathematics landed him a spot at the London School of Economics, alma mater of Mick Jagger, Margaret Thatcher, and George Soros. And along those lines, Gary attended school with the sons and daughters of the global elite, yet he stood out. We'll talk about that in a second. His skill at a card game won him a job on Citibank's trading desk, where he went on to earn multi-million dollar, that is, pound sterling, bonuses. Gary went on to become Citi's top trader, but eventually found that the game started to take a physical toll on him. The stress, pressure, and moral conflict of betting against poor people, or at least that's how he saw it, it led Gary to leave trading and begin to address growing income inequality around the globe. In this fast-paced, often humorous, and insight-rich conversation, the one you're about to listen to all the way to the end, that is, Gary and I discuss his new memoir, The Risks of Currency Trading, how he felt when he got his first bonus of $750,000 in his early 20s, the way other people's bias against working-class people worked to his advantage, why he knew it was time to quit the industry, the positive role of short sellers in a market, his new YouTube channel, Gary's Economics, and whether we should tax billionaires more and how exactly we should do it. You might not love every single part of this conversation, but I know you're going to love Gary and his story because he's an underdog that made good and worked hard to do it. And now he's off sincerely trying to improve the world in the way he knows how. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Gary Stevenson. I feel kind of like I know you because I've read this. I listened to your memoir, so I got to hear your East London accent talk about the finance game.
What's your stance on my American accents? I had to do about five different American accents.
Hit me with one real quick.
I think the Ben Bernanke accent was the best.
The Ben Bernanke. I don't know Ben's. I guess I'd have to go back and listen to some of Ben's stuff from 2008. Do your Ben Bernanke.
I was doing it to stay. You didn't catch it. That was my Ben Bernanke accent.
We think that M2 is exceedingly large and needs to be reduced. Is that close to Ben Bernanke? I don't know.
I think he's a bit squeakier, but although to be fair, it's a long time since I listened to Ben Bernanke.
Right.
But he's in the book.
Very entertaining read, very entertaining listen. Did you feel like, were you wary of letting people in, of sharing too much?
Not really. I think I wanted it to be really personal. I wanted you to feel like you're really experiencing. I was quite specific about the kind of like emotional space I wanted to put into the book. I wanted you to feel what I was feeling. So in terms of letting people into sort of me, I wanted to give you something very experiential.
No, I think you did. And when I listen to books, I really like it when the author reads it because you can inject personality and emotion in a way that an actor can't. So this is a very personal story. I was thinking, so like, I know he's Scottish, right? Ewan McGregor and Trainspotting was the image I had. And you guys look similar, you know, young Ewan McGregor.
Funny you say that. I'm literally reading the book Trainspotting right now, or like this morning. Have you read the book?
I have read the book. And it's incredible that you're reading the book and it's written in exactly that brogue, I guess.
It makes you read it in a Scottish accent. So I did want to do the audiobook because I really wanted the book to be written in this kind of London, East London language, the way that we speak. So I wanted to, I think you can see it a little bit in the prose written on the page.
Yeah.
But you get it more when I read it.
You said this is one of a very few American podcasts that you're doing. So thank you for recognizing my global thirst and desire to expose voices from all over the world. Tell me a little bit about the neighborhood you grew up in and what your childhood was like.
So I grew up in a place called Ilford, which is kind of in the sort of crappy suburbs of East London.
Not like Shoreditch that's been gentrified and all that.
No. Not like the fancy East London. You know, the British terraced housing, long rows of terraced housing, street, mm-hmm. Small terraced house. I was sharing a small bedroom, sharing a bunk bed with my brother, train tracks running through the back garden.
Oh, really?
It was this kind of, you know, kids playing in the street. But we were poor. We were poor growing up. It's a very, very immigrant neighborhood I grew up in. lots of South Asians, lots of British Indians, lots of British Pakistanis. But being in East London, we're quite close to the financial district, right? So there's two financial districts in London, I guess you're probably aware. We have the City, which is like the old-fashioned financial district, which has been there for years and years. Well, thousands of years. And then we have this new one, which went up when I was a kid, called Canary Wharf. And I'm talking to you from very close to that now. When I was a kid, this sort of new skyscraper district went up in the distance. And we could see it from the street, like playing football in the street. We could see these go up.
This is the 90s?
Yeah, in the 90s, yeah. So I was born in 86. So yeah, in the 90s, we start seeing the skyscraper district go up. I was a very talented mathematician. I used to win like a few math competitions. And everybody just kind of assumes, including me, you know, one day we'll grow up and we'll go and work in these skyscrapers, obviously without really knowing what was going on in there at the time.
And your dad was a postal worker.
My dad worked for Royal Mail for 35 years. And he used to take the train that went down the back of the house into central London. So he used to get into work really early. And my mum used to wake us up in the morning, like 5 a.m., 5:30, try and see my dad in the train. And yeah, he wasn't earning much money. And my mum was largely a stay-at-home mum. She worked as a social worker for a few years. But yeah, just kind of a regular poor East London multicultural upbringing, I guess.
You said you were good at math, and that's clearly essential to the story here. When did you discover that you knew what was going on in the maths world?
Always, really. I think my mum picked up on it when I was really young. She would get me these little maths like exercise books, and I would be like ripping through them. And obviously you get to school and you come in first in all the maths exams. It probably wasn't really until I got to 11. So here in the UK, we still have in some places this system where the kids take an exam at age 10, and that decides whether you're going to go to like the clever school or the regular school. So I passed, it doesn't happen everywhere, but it used to be the whole country, but we still have it. And I passed this test when I was 10, and then I went off to the kind of fancy school, which is supposed to kind of imitate the private schools, of which we still have a lot here in England. And I kind of thought it's going to be full of smart kids, but I sort of went there and I was still just like breezing through the maths. And then I think a lot of the kids there used to say, they were maybe a little bit jealous I was beating them in the exams, and they'd say, we know you're studying. Because I was that kind of annoying kid in the class who's just like making jokes at the back and still doing well. But then you come back to my house and I didn't even have a desk to study on, you know. So I could kind of see these guys are studying, I'm not studying. Somehow I'm still getting number one in all the exams, and you start to realize you've got something going for you, I guess.
Did you take any grief from the kids in the neighborhood for going to the fancy school?
You know what? Not really. I think they, even now, to be honest, like they like to see themselves represented, you know, like somebody who talks like them, speaks like them, dresses like them. I mean, later when I was 16, and this is mentioned in the book as well, I got expelled from that school for selling drugs.
For entrepreneurship.
Yeah, entrepreneurship, we'll say. And had to go back to the local school with the kids from my primary school, you know, who I was studying with when I was 9 or 10. And they thought that was hilarious, obviously. No, I think they, even now, it's what's really funny, my mates from, because I went to this fancy school, I've got some mates from poorer backgrounds, some mates from richer backgrounds. But my mates from poorer backgrounds, they love it because I still talk like them, I still dress like them, and they love to see me, you know, up there with the big dogs, and they like to see themselves represented, I think.
And how'd you find your way into university?
So I just did really well in my exams. I got expelled from school when I was 16. Then I had to go to a new school, 17 and 18. And that was really difficult because obviously I had to tell everyone I've just been expelled for selling drugs. But then it was really weird because I had like great exam grades, but also expelled for selling drugs. But then once you apply to university from my new school, I didn't have to tell them. I didn't have to disclose that I got expelled. You know, the permanent record doesn't exist, basically, at least not here. So I did really well in my exams. I did maths, physics, English literature and sociology. I got 4 A's, which is the top grade you could have got at the time in England. I got into the London School of Economics, which is, it's not as famous as Oxford or Cambridge. So I guess some people might not have even heard of it, but the London School of Economics is an extremely prestigious university. This is kind of a place where, like, Gaddafi sent his kids there. And it's kind of that kind of place, like the head guys in the Chinese government or like big industrialists in Kenya or India, they'll send their kids to the London School of Economics. And it's full of this kind of international money. But I got in because I got great exam grades, basically.
Did you feel like you fit in there?
I'm the first person in my family to ever go to university. I thought it was going to be like American Pie. That was when I was into it. That's when I was a teenager. That was a big movie, right? So I was thinking like...
By the way, that's exactly how American universities are. It's just like American Pie.
This is because that's what I was imagining, right? And I turned up and I remember I was studying maths and economics. Yeah. So I was in the maths department. And they sent us all on a like, get-to-know-each-other trip to like a fancy like manor house in the British countryside called Cumberland Lodge. I was like, this is going to be great. Definitely going to get laid. I bought like a 3-liter bottle of like cider from the supermarket. And I turned up and I was like, everyone was like meeting in this one room. So I brought my cider and I was like, this is going to be a massive party. They opened the door. I went in there. They were playing chess in there. And they was like, what's that? And I said, that's my cider. And they were like, don't spill it on the floor. And then I realized that this was not unfortunately going to be like American Pie, which is a great shame because it would have been fun. People couldn't understand my accent. And then I went in wearing an Echo tracksuit, which was like a kind of onesie with like a big rhino on the front. But that's what we used to wear. But I didn't. I mean, you've read the book, so you see, I was a confident kid and I backed myself. Like I wasn't sort of from the same spaces, but I knew I could beat these guys in the maths. And to be honest, I thought it would be fun to have like the Pakistani government pay 100 grand to send their kids across the world to be beat in their exams by me. And it was quite fun.
That's hilarious. When I went to business school, I was from the southern United States. And if you want to do a dumb accent in the United States, you talk like this. You say, hey, I'm a dummy. I'm from Georgia and I think backwards and all that. And in some cases, that's true. But often you meet all these people that'll play up their southern accent and you realize these are the smartest guys in the room. How did it feel to be unexpectedly intelligent in that environment?
Well, this was the thing. So LSE, your first year, doesn't count a lot. So I didn't really study hard my first year. I just got my first girlfriend. I was 19. She was the year below. So she was still in high school and I was like first year college. And I spent a lot of time back home in Ilford. And I didn't study that much. And I got a first, which is the top grade you can get in your first year. I turned up second year. Everybody suddenly knew who I was. People would come up and ask me, like, can I study with you and this kind of thing? And I was very confused. So I spoke to one of my friends, Sagam Alde. That's his real name in the book. He was a really nice boy. His dad owned the entire East African soap industry. And I said to him, why does everybody know who I am? And he said to me, oh, because of your grades. And that didn't really make sense because Saga was number one in the maths department in first year. So I said to him, well, your grades are better than mine. And he said to me, well, yeah, of course. But nobody expects that from you. And I was, honestly, because I was always the poor kid in grammar school. That's what we call these fancy schools here in England. But everybody knew that I was the best student and nobody was ever surprised when I got good grades. And I turn up at LSE with all these international millionaires who, to be honest, most of the time, a lot of these guys go to university to find a wife. You know what I mean? They're not really interested in like, and then suddenly they were surprised. And I think that kind of got a little bee in my bonnet, which I used that. That was one of the sort of this idea that I would be underestimated. I kind of used that throughout my whole career. And it's a big theme throughout the book, basically.
Yeah. But you're also like showing up in tracksuits, that kind of thing. Like you're a member of the band The Streets or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of The Streets. I'm glad. Is he famous in the States? I didn't think you guys knew him.
He had a couple of hits that broke through like 20 years ago, but I don't think there's been much since then.
He's a good lad. Yeah, but that's what we wear. You know, even it's so funny. I've got my YouTube channel and people post on it. Why is this guy dressing like that? Why is he wearing those gloves? Why is he wearing that hat? And it's like, there's a theory on the internet that my whole persona is like me pretending to be the Artful Dodger. And in reality, I live in like a palace somewhere.
You need one of those caps, those driver caps.
I'm from East London. This is how we speak. And this is where I'm from. So yeah, I did wear tracksuits. And LSE is a funny place, especially when you get into your second year. People start, which is internship year, people start wearing suits, coming in suits. And it's a little bit intimidating. But, you know, somebody once told me when I was a kid, if you want to get somewhere, you're going to have to change how you talk. You're going to change how you dress. And I said to him, if I have to change how I talk and how I dress, there's no point being somebody. You got to be yourself. Nobody else is going to do it.
So how did you learn about the trading game?
All right. So I get into second year. Everyone goes mental. Everyone goes absolutely. Suddenly everyone is applying for 35 internships. They start wearing suits. They start talking entirely in three-letter acronyms. Everything is a CDS or a CBO or an MBS or an MBA or an M&A. You don't know what, I had no idea what was going on. They stopped going to lectures. All they're doing is applying. 35 investment banks. I couldn't even name you 35 investment banks, probably even now, never mind then, right? I speak to the guys, like, what do we have to do? They're like, you've got to apply for investment banks. And obviously at that point, second year uni, you don't have your grades yet, right? So you can't go in and be like, well, I got the number one grades. So So what you're applying in is CV and cover letter. So it's basically based 100% on your extracurriculars, which means in the end of the day, these jobs are given out basically based on how good you are at clarinet. And obviously all of these guys, all of these guys around me from like very well-off backgrounds, they'd been being like trained from like 4 years old. You know, they'd been doing their clarinet lessons. You know, everybody was like head of the Junior United Nations, or like one guy founded a charity that drove dirt bikes through the Sahara Desert for some reason. I don't know who that helps. But I tried to be a grime rapper, and I was fluffing pillows at a sofa store in East London, you know, my weekends. And it was like, there's no way I'm going to get in it. So I basically gave up applying for banks. I was quite disappointed. But I started making myself like very loud on campus, and I started like sitting in the front of lectures and harassing the lecturers. And I kind of hoped that, because I knew I was smart and I had a rep for being smart, I hoped somebody would notice. And basically that worked. So one day I was sitting in the library, and a guy from Grimsby, which is a rather grim Northern English town, who I'd never met before, year above, wandered up to me in the library and said, "Are you Gary Stevenson?" I said, "Yes." He goes, "Citibank hires one trader a year through a card game, which is basically a maths game. I heard you're good at maths. You should enter this game. And if you win, you can get a job." And that is the trading game, the game from which the book gets its title. And that's how I got my job.
So explain the game as briefly and as high level as you can.
Really, it's a betting game. It's kind of a poker style game. So there's a special deck of cards, some low cards, some high cards. It's minus 10, plus 20, and 1 through 15. There's five of us. We all get a card. So I can see my card, so I know if it's low or high. There's three other cards face down on the table. And basically, we start to bet with one another on what we think the total of those cards will be. All of our five cards plus the three on the bottom. And the three at the bottom get turned over during the game. It was actually super easy to win that game at first. And the reason for that is, did you study like economics? You said you've been to business school. I guess you've...
Yeah, I did study economics, though my professors wouldn't necessarily admit that that's true.
Okay. Straight away, almost everyone with an economics degree will do the same thing when presented with this game. They will do a mathematical calculation.
Exactly.
Calculate the expected value. Anyone with economics training will calculate the expected value. Because if you've got a low card, your expected value is lower because you know one of the cards is very low. And then people would start betting around their own expected value, which seems very sensible, but it's actually quite stupid. First of all, this is because you give away straight away what your card is if you start betting on your expected value. But secondly, because it's a betting game, if everyone is betting on their expected value, you'll get one guy here with a low card, one guy here with a high card. This guy will be saying, "I'm betting it's going to be 47. And this guy will be saying, "I'm betting it's 63. So I would just buy at 47, sell at 63, buy at 47, sell at 63, again and again and again. And it was absurdly easy to win, which it shouldn't have been really. And I think I only probably got away with it because of this thing, which is that rich kids expect poor kids to be stupid. And they probably thought I had no idea what I was doing, basically. But yeah, I won. That got me through to the final. And then I had to go to the big Citigroup Tower in Canary Wharf, which, of course, is one of the towers I saw growing up as a kid, play against other guys from the top universities. And I won that as well. And that's how I got my job.
Hey, everybody. We'll be right back with Gary in just a second. But I want to let you know that I'll be telling jokes live and in person near you very soon. And you should come out and see it. April 18th, I'll be at the Atlanta Athletic Club. I'll be hosting for Jay Larson, the very funny Jay Larson from Los Angeles, California. He's actually from Massachusetts, but now lives in LA. April 19th and 20th, I'll be at the DC Comedy Loft in the District of Columbia that is Washington, DC, our nation's capital. Co-headlining the DC Comedy Loft with Paul Farivar for our Two Pauls, One Show. May 3rd and 4th, I'll be solo headlining the Denver Comedy Lounge in Denver, Colorado. So come out and see that May 3rd and 4th. May 17th, Paul and I will be at the Cary Theater, Two Pauls, One Show at the Cary Theater in Cary, North Carolina. The next night we'll be at the Idiot Box in Greensboro, North Carolina. That's May 18th. And then Memorial Day weekend, May 24th through 26th, I will be in Vail, Colorado for the Vail Comedy Festival. Some good stuff coming up. We also have dates coming up in Vero Beach in June, around Florida, and then Dallas. I believe that's in September. Dallas, we're coming for you. See the link in the show notes to all these shows. Hope to see you out live. Now back to Gary Stevenson. What did you think trading was? I mean, the actual trading industry. What did you know about it? What did you think it was before you started in the corporate world?
You know, I didn't have a TV in my like bedroom or anything like that, and I didn't grow up watching films. So I hadn't even seen these old like Wall Street or these sort of classic trading movies. I hadn't seen any of them. So really, honestly, I had absolutely no idea. I think it's kind of a gift that I received in terms of the book, because I didn't do this thing that other LSD students were doing, which is really inculcate yourself, steep yourself in the culture and the language of trading.
And try to fit into that thing as to what you thought it was based on pop culture and CNBC or whatever the financial news press is.
Which is what a lot of people do if they come from a place like London School of Economics or whatever, like any of the big universities in the States, I'm sure will be the same. People turn up and they think they're supposed to be a certain way. Whereas I won my job in a card game and I was working fluffing pillows on the weekend. Right? So I turned up on the trading floor and I just kind of just, but I had this confidence, like if you guys can do it, I can do it. You know, I'm as good as anybody. So I just turned up on the trading floor and obviously, I guess you know what trading floor looks like. Massive, massive room, Citibank London trading floor. Loads of rows of guys with these huge walls of screens. I turned up in the morning, it was quite quiet. And they don't give you anywhere to sit. They don't give you any work to do. And your job is to kind of, when you're an intern, this is, poke around and try and sort of make friends. And I just did what I did when I was working my weekend job, which was ask the guys, all right, you know, I'm Gary. Do you want me to go pick your lunch up? Do you want me to grab your coffee? The weird thing is they loved it. I was super popular straight away. I think they sort of sensed this, I don't know, naivety. There's also, especially here in London, we have this kind of mythological figure of the Cockney wide boy, artful dodger, wheeler, dealer, trader. And back sort of 20, 30 years ago, there were, because the trading floors are in East London, there are a lot of East Londoners on the trading floor. Nowadays, when you go there, it's largely people from richer backgrounds. But I think to see me turn up like really clearly fresh, naive, young, sort of aggressive, not knowing what I was doing, I think the traders loved it because it made true this idea that trading floors are meritocracies that take in the best people. And they kind of took me under their wing straight away.
Eventually, you get your book. Describe what a book is and what your responsibility is and how you make money for the bank.
All right. So there's a ton of different trading desks. My specific trading desk was called short-term interest rate trading, which to simplify a little bit is basically making loans. You lend money, you borrow money. You want to lend the money at a high interest rate and borrow it back at a low interest rate. That's where you make your money. But being a massive commercial bank, obviously Citibank is one of the biggest commercial banks in the world, you're also serving customers. So if you want to come in and borrow Swiss francs or lend Swiss francs, you'll call up your bank. Imagine you're a massive corporation, like you're Sony or something. You need to borrow Swiss francs. You will call up somebody at Citibank and that person at Citibank, the sales guy, will go to the trader. And who is the trader who manages Swiss francs? Well, that is the guy who owns the Swiss franc book. And if you get a book, if you have a lot of customers, you'll have guys coming in every day that want to borrow, want to lend, want to borrow, want to lend.
But why would Sony want to borrow Swiss francs, just for example?
Maybe they're opening a shop in Switzerland. Simple as that, basically. Or, you know, it might be something like a pension fund. You know, you're a big American pension fund and you want to diversify your assets. You don't want to hold all of your assets in the States. So you want to buy some Swiss assets. You know, you have some Japanese assets, some European assets, some British assets. Investors, corporations, yeah, they're international. So you want to borrow some Swiss francs.
Okay.
At the end of the day, you basically get them from somebody like me. So my job after a few years was the Swiss franc trader. You come to me, basically, and I get your Swiss francs. If I run the book, if it's a busy book, like, for example, the Euro book is really big here in London, you'll have lots of customers coming in a day, some borrowing, some lending. And basically, you'll take a little cut. So you'll lend at, you know, 0.56%. You'll borrow back at 0.54% from all the customers. It's really similar. You know, when you get your travel money, you go over here in the UK, it's called Thomas Cook. I don't know who you go to there in the States. You go in and you're coming to Britain. We buy pounds at this level, we sell pounds at this level, people are coming in on both sides, and you're taking what we would call in the markets, that spread in between.
And in Vegas, they'd call that the VIG.
The VIG, yeah. Really, it's just that. It's the little spread between what you buy at and what you sell at, that if you get 100 guys coming in every day on both sides, you take your little snippet of each of that, and that money adds up.
Okay, so why not just lend as much as you possibly can?
So we as the traders, on the cert desk I was on, we had to fund our own loans. So if I lend you money, I need to borrow it back from somewhere. So we can't just lend, we have to borrow. We have to, as a trader, we have to square our books.
And so the risk is what?
The risk is, say you come to me and you want a long-term loan, like a one-year, well, first of all, I should be clear, short-term interest rates trading is what would classify in the banks as short-term loans. So we're doing loans of up to 2 years. There's another desk which sits a million miles away and we never talk to them that does longer loans, 2 to 10 years. So we're doing loans of up to 2 years. So for us, a 1 year loan might be a long period of time. You come to me and you say, I want to borrow Swiss francs for 1 year. I give you your price. There's your Swiss francs. Basically, I need to fund that. I have a few ways of doing that. I can either find someone else to lend me money for a year, or I can borrow the money back every day, one day at a time, which tends to be what we do. So what would happen is, when you ask for your 1 year loan, we will make a prediction for what's going to happen to the interest rates in the next course of the year. So right now, you know, US rates are up in the 4%, but people think they're going to come down, right? You come to me for a loan and I say I'll lend you 4% because I think rates are going to go down. What if rates don't go down? What if rates actually go up and end up being 5%? I could be in a situation where I've lent you dollars for 4% and I end up having to borrow them back at 5%. So basically, we are taking the risk on the way that interest rates move over time. So what we will be doing is, we will be looking absolutely obsessively at the Fed in the States, or the Bank of England here in the UK, or the European Central Bank, the guys on the panel. What are they going to do? What are they going to do in their rate decision next month, the month after? Where are rates going to be next year? This is the kind of stuff we're obsessing about.
And what was it that made you good at this, besides being good at math?
To be honest, I think the math I never really used. So basically, first thing that happens is, this desk was a very unfashionable desk pre-2008. Because we're making short-term loans, everybody knows what the rate's probably going to be next month. There's not a lot of risk in it, so there's not a lot of VIG, basically. In 2008, after Lehman blows up, suddenly everybody needs dollars and nobody can get them. We're a massive American bank. We have dollars. We're able to lend dollars out at high interest rates. We have access to the Federal Reserve. We can get the dollars in the Federal Reserve. It became hugely profitable and loads of guys made a lot of money. Really, I just sort of blindly start copying the guys around me, and I make a ton of money in 2009. Not because I'm good, just because I happen to be in the right seat at the right time, basically. In 2010, I got smashed. So you've read the books. There's one story where the Swiss National Bank unexpectedly cuts interest rates to -4.5%, and I lose $8 million in a week. Mm-hmm. And this kind of starts me on my sort of new stage in my progression, which I think is something a lot of people will be able to relate to, which is that stage in your life where you realize you don't get good by copying the people around you. You get good by working shit out for yourself.
Mm. Okay, let's go back to how you're living at this time. Now, you're on the desk for a while, but you're still living at home. Tell me how you're getting ready every morning.
Yes, I was still living with my parents. My first 18 months working as a trader, I was living with my parents. You know, my dad also started work early, so we'd sort of fight for the bathroom. I was getting into work really early. Little rubber bath, we had to put this rubber hose on and shower in the bath.
Didn't have a proper shower.
No, I think my parents, well, they've moved out of the house now. Yeah, you used to buy this little rubber hose you stick onto the taps. I don't know if you have them in the States, but yeah, you stick the hose onto the taps and you sit in the bath. Yeah.
And then you're going to the office where people are making millions of dollars a year, millions of pounds a year, right? So tell me about how the bonus system works and the story of getting your first bonus.
Back then, I think it has changed since, especially here in London. Back then, basically, your salary is not massive. I was making £36,000 a year, which back then would have been about $60,000, which I thought was enormous. In my mind, it was enormous. But the big money is in the bonus. But I had no idea what the bonuses were going to be. And what I really wanted, my sort of vision was, I want to make £100,000 bonus. For me, like £100,000, like that is £100,000 is the amount of money you want to hit. So I kind of cornered my boss. My boss quit and he told me, you can ask me any question. And I say to him, what do I have to do to make £100,000? And he's like, you can't do it. There's no way. And I was like, just tell me. He goes, you have to make $10 million for the bank. So like, I go back to the desk. I sort of figure my numbers out, figure out what trade's going to make me. I wanted to make 12, bit of margin for error. Managed to get the trade on. End of the year, make my $12 million. And I was expecting to get paid like 120 grand, basically, because 10 million is 100, so 12 million should be 120. I go into the office, sitting down opposite my boss, who in the book is a guy, we've called him Chuck, absolute enormous Canadian giant, puts the paper down on the desk and I'm looking for like 120 grand. It's not on there. The number at the top is 395 grand. And I say to him, is it that number? He starts laughing and he says, yeah, it's that number. And I remember like it was yesterday. I remember exactly what I said. I said, wow, that's a lot of money. And it was crazy. I went back to the maddest thing is, then my next memory after that, and we write about this in the book, I'm sitting on the desk and I felt like I was going to start crying. And I just didn't understand why. And I worked with this guy who's sort of my trading guru. He's another guy from a working class background. Didn't go to university. He's a guy called Bill. He comes around the other side of me so the other traders can't see me. He says, look, go sit outside, have a little rest. And I sat outside. There's a little sort of square of grass in the middle of the skyscrapers in this Canary Wharf skyscraper district. And the first thing I thought was my dad. My dad on that train every morning. Every morning, in early morning, back late in the day, tired in the evening. How hard he works for £20,000 a year, you know. And all that, I start thinking of the kids I went to primary school with and their dads, you know. I grew up in a very immigrant area. A lot of recent migrants from Pakistan living like big family in a small house, sleeping on the sofa. And you think of how hard all these guys' parents worked for 20 grand. And there was me. I just turned 23 and I made £395,000.
Which, to remind everybody, that's pounds, which was trading at about 2 to 1. So almost 800, $750,000.
It would have been like 700. Yeah, yeah. Not far off $750,000 when I just turned 23. And
a massive, massive amount of money for a young guy.
Like, if it was 100, what I was expecting, that was something I could kind of visualize. But £400,000 was just, and I think I put in the book, I put there, I think that something changed in me that day and something changed in my career. And from then on, it wasn't a career. From then on, it was bank robbery. Because the next thing you think about all of your mates, but then the next thing you think is, well, if I made $395,000, what did Rupert make? You know, what did those guys in the pink shirts over there make? You know, what did Bill, what did these? And then you start thinking, well, why are these guys allowed to make £1 million quid a year, and why are we not allowed to make it? And then I think what you see in that scene is there's a battle that goes on in my head between some sort of questions about justice and I guess basically greed in a way. And you see this rationalization of greed. I'm saying, well, why not us? Why not the kids from the street? But really, I just want the money. I want the money for me. But I also wanted to be the best trader. And, you know, that was a big motivator too.
Let's go to year number two. It's actually year number three because you got a tiny bonus.
Year number three, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So let's get to year number three. What happens?
So I get smashed in year number two and I lose a lot of money and I become obsessed with understanding the economy. What you need to understand about interest rates, this is quite interesting, right, is we, the economists and the market, have a horribly bad track record of predicting interest rates. Basically, they predicted interest rates would recover every single year from 2008 till 2020, which was wrong every year here in the UK. Finally, in 2020, they say rates will never go up again. And that's when rates go to 5%. So we're really, really bad at this, right?
Right.
And I'm sitting at the beginning of 2011, surrounded by millionaires who get paid £1 million a year to predict interest rates, who have so far, I've not seen them successfully predict interest rates a single time. And I'm trying to understand, why are we always wrong when we try to predict interest rate? You know, I studied at a fancy economics university. So I know the theory, right? Low interest rates are supposed to get you spending. So I go back and I start asking my mates, you know, back in Ilford, why aren't you spending more money? You know, if you've never done this, I strongly recommend this as a way to understand what's happening in the world. Ask people why they don't spend more money and they'll tell you, you know, obviously you can imagine, you know, 80, 90% of these guys say, I don't spend more money because I don't have any money. So I start digging around my friends' financial situations. And what I see in almost every case is, back then I'm in my early 20s, I see an older generation of property owners and a younger generation who will never be able to own property. So what you have here is basically the loss of wealth of the middle class. And it makes no sense to ask these guys, why aren't you spending more money? You know, if you're on a long-term trajectory to zero, I can't say why don't you spend more money, because it's obvious, right? And the next idea bouncing around in 2011 was, okay, the consumer is weak, but government will come in and spend. And I get called into a meeting with one of Citibank's top economists. I've called him, I think, Timothy Prince in the book. And he goes through the financial situation of all of the major Western governments, obviously Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Ireland, but also the UK, the US, Japan. Basically, in every case, massive deficits, debts increasing, selling off their assets over time. And I was really struck by the symmetry between the financial situation of my friends and their families and Western governments. In both cases, you're losing your assets, you're spending more than your income, you're going into debt. And the other thing I was struck by was that it's kind of impossible, right? We can't all lose our assets at the same time. You know, they're not being destroyed. And also, we can't all go into debt at the same time. You know, if someone is in debt, someone else has to be in credit. And I was rattling this around my head one day, and then I suddenly realized, you know, I'm sitting in this skyscraper surrounded by millionaires, and I realized, well, it's us. We are the balance. This is what is happening. What is happening is wealth is flowing out of the middle class, out of governments, towards millionaires and billionaires, and it will never flow back. And what that means is the economy will never recover. And I put this massive bet on that interest rates will never go up. And by the end of that year, 2011, I become Citibank's most profitable trader in the world.
So what do the numbers look like for that?
So that year I made $35 million. I think $35 million probably wouldn't in a normal year.
For the bank,
year.
Your book made $35
million. Yeah, sorry, for the bank. Well, I wouldn't say the book, because when you say the book, that kind of assumes from the customers. But I had a big speculative bet on, basically. Mm-hmm. And in a normal year, $35 million probably wouldn't be enough to be Citibank's top trader of the year. But that year, everybody, 2011, because that was the year that inflation started to creep back in. Mm-hmm. And everybody was thinking, recovery is coming. And everyone was betting on the recovery, which is why I managed to make so much money betting against the recovery, basically. But that year, 2011, I made $35 million for Citibank and was Citibank Global Foreign Exchange and Local Markets top trader in the year.
How big was your bonus that year?
Basically, I won 7%. What is weird is by this time in my career, I've become so obsessed with trading. The only way I know my bonus is I know that I had $35 million P&L and I know I won 7%. So you can work that out. It's going to be something like $2.3 million, something like that. That's what I got, something around those sort of lines.
You talked about the conflict. On the one hand, you recognized how much more this was than everybody you knew made. On the other hand, you felt like, well, I made this money, I deserve it. What were the emotions going through you as the numbers got bigger?
You know, so that year I become like Citibank's top trader in the world, and I was still only 24. I turned 25 late in that year. It's a really surreal experience because, you know, I was basically like everybody's comedy cockney sidekick when I turned up, right? And now I'm 24 and like I am the big trader, right? And there's like the big boss wants to come over. We call him the slug in the book. Big boss wants to come over and go for dinner with me personally. And all of the brokers want to take you out. And, you know, one of my mates from high school got a job as a broker, and it's suddenly you get surrounded by kind of all of the worst people in the world. And I was kind of aware that I didn't like it. But because of this nature of the payment structure, which is you don't get paid anything till the end of the year, you cannot piss anyone off. So you're getting swarmed by all these people you hate, and you just have to be nice to them. And I started to get sick, basically.
And a big chunk of that bonus is deferred payment, right? You don't get it right away. You get it vests over years, right?
Yeah, mine was structured in such. You do get a chunk up front, but then a big chunk of it is some next year, some next year, some next year. And I think it was 4 years until you fully receive it. That's another part of it, which you see. You have this kind of golden handcuffs element.
Yeah. All right. So you start to feel some physical symptoms. Tell me about those.
Yeah. So, you know, I really like this massive Canadian giant who is my boss, Chuck. And he has to leave, which for reasons I won't spoil because they're in the book. And a new guy comes over who I've called the Frog, who is a guy from the New York desk who, suffice to say, I didn't like him a lot. And he becomes my new boss, and he sits next to me, tells terrible jokes every day, and I just have to laugh at his jokes.
That's my former colleagues had to deal with, right? Yeah.
He sort of fires one of my best mates, and I can't do anything about it because I can't piss anyone off. And I start to get this pains in my stomach, like shooting acid like through my heart, which I think is this kind of gastric reflux. And now I think it was definitely a stress response, but I didn't really know. And if I didn't eat for like 3 hours, I would start getting these agonizing just pains up through my heart. And I didn't, you know, you go to the doctor and he gives you pills and the pills fix it, but it comes back and you keep going back. And I couldn't really address anything because I was just obsessed with, I need to get to the end of the year because this, you know, there's $2.5 million on the line. You come from the background I come from, you know, that $2.5 million, I will live on that for the rest of my life. That's financial security for me and my family and everything. So you're having this pain and you kind of know you hate it, and other people around my life are sort of falling apart, but you have to just stay on the track. You can't make a single mistake. And it wasn't good for my mental health, which I think is very clear from the book.
Did money change how people treated you?
This is a really good question, right? So I was always like the poor kid in school. I was the kid. Do you have non-uniform day in America?
Oh, I went to Catholic school, so we had uniforms. Okay. And then if you go to public school, there's generally no uniforms. But so yeah, out of uniform day was a big deal for us.
Yeah, so we obviously like have to wear uniform. We have non-uniform day. And I was the kid that had to wear his uniform for non-uniform day because he didn't have nothing to wear. You know what I mean? Couldn't go on the school trips, that kind of thing, you know. And I always remember when we turned 16 and all my friends' parents would like give them money for their grades. And they'd use that money, or they'd give them a car for their grades. And I remember one overhearing two girls say, "Oh, have you seen Raj's new car? He must be doing really well for himself." And I remember thinking, "We're 16. What do you think he's doing?" But obviously, my parents weren't giving me nothing. My grades were the best in the school, you know. And you get judged. And then this first year, I make this big bonus and I told some of my friends about it so people find out about it. One thing I really remember is I was still wearing the same like cheap clothes from like cheap shops. People would start being like, oh, that's a nice shirt. Where'd you get that shirt from? And it would be the same. It would be the same shirt as ever. So what you see is like suddenly that judgment stops, but then this, you stop being judged for being poor, but immediately you're being judged for being rich. And my friends would be like, you know, why don't you get the drinks and why don't you get the rounds in it? At that time in my life, I basically stopped drinking. I wasn't even drinking. People are like, why don't you get around in? And it was really weird for me. I'd never been on the other side of it, on the other side of being the guy who's making a ton of money. It's only now I'm sort of in my 30s and I see other friends making a lot of money. I know what it feels like to have your mate make a ton of money. But, you know, I was 23. You know, I sort of thought my friends would be happy for me. But it was, I think it probably was difficult for my friends to see me make these inhuman amounts of money when we were so young.
What'd you buy?
First, I bought this flat, which I live in now, which is quite a nice flat in close, like on the water in London. Other than this, I bought a £3,000 black Vespa. You know what a Vespa is?
Yeah,
those little Italian fancy motorbikes. To be honest, that's it. I can't think of a single other expensive thing that I bought.
How'd you invest the rest?
Well, a lot of it comes in the form of city stock, this stuff that was vested. It comes through slowly, right? So first I bought this property. That was sort of the big thing. You know what? I made a ton of investments, a ton. I become like, there's a scene in the book, which I think is quite moving if I say so myself, which is when I make this $2 million bonus, I go home straight away. I'm in the corner of my front room, my little office space, doing my investments. And the girl who I was dating at the time, we call her Wizard in the book. She comes around and as soon as she walks in, I can see that she can see I'm stressed. And that pisses me off immediately. And she comes over to me. She's like, you're right. And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. It's good. It's good. And she's like, well, you seem quite stressed. And I say to her, well, of course I'm stressed. I've got to invest $2 million. This is a lot of money, right? and she says to me, am I allowed to swear? Because I swear.
Sure. Yeah. Let's do it.
She says to me, if I just made as much money as you've just made, the last thing I'd be doing is sitting in the corner of my front room stressing out. I think I put in the book, as soon as she said that, I knew she was right. And I really fucking hated her for that.
Yeah.
Because I'd become like a machine. I'd become like, as soon as the money come in, how do I invest it? How do I invest it? And I made so many investments that it complicated my life for about 7 years because I had all of these investments around. It was just like, and I think, especially if you study things like economics and maths and business, I've kind of been trained to become this kind of optimizing money-making machine. And I'd never even really stopped to ask myself, why? This is just what the world tells you to be if you're a young man, you know. It tells you, listen, you are the money you make. You need to make more money. And if you make money, you're great. And I think all my mates around me, because they've been told the same thing, they thought, well, Gary must be really, really fucking happy, basically. But like, looking back in hindsight, I was obviously slipping into a depression and a burnout. And the money was never making me happy. But I'd been told this was everything I was supposed to do. So to be honest, I was confused. I was really confused.
So walk me through that. Your brain, your body is telling you it's time to go. How do you make the final decision that you're going to walk away from this game?
I think the big thing was the day I walk in after that big bonus, because everything was about this bonus. Everything was about this bonus, which I would have received at the beginning of 2012. And, you know, it has to be this whatever, $2.2 million, whatever it has to be, it has to be, it has to be. And then you make it. You make that money. You make your $2.3 million. And you go into work the next day. You sit down. And you just think, why the fuck am I here? I've made the money. Last year, I was Citibank's best trader in the entire world. Like, where do I go from that? Any more money I make at this point is just Sonic the Hedgehog money, you know? And I think what you need to add on top of that, the way I was making the money was betting on the total collapse of the economy, the long-term total collapse of the economy. And this is something which nobody around me ever really stopped to question, but that's what I was betting on. And this part of you, because you're making the money and you realize you're not enjoying it. And then you say to yourself, well, in that case, I'm going to make it for my kids. I'm going to give my kids a better life than I had. But then you realize the thing you're making the money on is the total collapse of society. And then you think, well, that's not going to be good for my fucking kids, is it? But it's kind of a mad thing on the trading floor, especially on these desks where you're betting on economic strength. Have you seen The Big Short?
Sure.
You must have seen it.
Yeah.
There's that one famous scene where the two guys bet against the economy and they're dancing and Brad Pitt is like, stop dancing. do you know what it means when you bet against the economy?
Right.
You remember this scene?
Yeah.
And obviously it was, I felt it personally, but you know, nobody on the trading floor tells you if the economy collapses, there's not a bell you can ring. You know what I mean? You can't ring the bell in the corner, ding, 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 economy's collapsing. You know, that's not how our society is structured. The way our society is structured is the best paid 10,000 economists in the world all bet on whether it'll be good or not. And the guys who actually try to stop it from collapsing are paid like 60 grand a year. That's the way the world works.
Okay, but yeah, playing devil's advocate here, you had a crisis of conscience, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of ways to make money when the economy is growing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you bet that the economy is going to go, if the stock market's going to go up as it has for many, many years, perhaps fueled by these very, very low interest rates that aren't good for society in the long run. But there are ways to make money when the economy is growing. Also, if you don't make those trades, somebody else is going to make those trades. And the short sellers who profit when things go down, they're kind of like the scavengers that keep the oceans clean, right? That they,
yeah,
that they are out there demonstrating the weakness in the market. And those guys in The Big Short were like basically saying, hey, these banks are corrupt. These rating agencies are corrupt. They are lying to you. And this is wrong. And this needs to be corrected. How else do you do it if you're a little guy, yeah, you know, who's, and those guys were pretty much little guys when they were making those bets.
Yeah. You know what? I 100% agree with that. I don't think the short sellers are the guys that are at fault here. And I don't think the traders who bet on collapse, you need these guys. These are the guys who in their own way are trying to ring the bell. You know what I mean? They're saying, yeah, things are broken. You know, it is 100% not the fault of these guys. I think the problem we have is that society will pay people like me $2.5 million a year to bet on society collapsing. But I've been out here now doing my YouTube for 4 years trying to say, guys, can we stop society from collapsing? And I can't even talk to government for free. I could walk into any skyscraper. They're just over there. I could walk into any one of them skyscrapers and get paid £1 million a year.
Yep.
The government won't even talk to me. And what I'm doing is betting on society collapsing. That is the problem, right?
So let's talk about what you've done since you've left. You walk away, you got a few million bucks in the bank, a few million pounds. You can do whatever you want because you live small. You're not a greedy guy. How do you decide, yeah, what to do when you can do anything?
I strongly believe that in the absence of really significantly increased taxes on the very, very rich, we will see over the next 10, 15, 20 years, enormous increases in poverty in the UK, in the US, in the whole Western world. I think we will move towards a situation where the average living standard is dreadfully bad, similar to what it is in places like India or Brazil or South Africa. And I think it will be horrible. I think the US will become a horrible place to live. I think the UK will become a horrible place to live. The kind of people who will be suffering will be the people who I grew up with, people exactly like me growing up. And I don't want that to happen. And I think the only way to stop that is to stop this dramatic increase in inequality. So I come out of the bank and I kind of think, there's this great scene at the end, like towards the end of the book, where I'm sort of being kicked out to Tokyo and I'm talking to this like very wealthy Australian young boy trader. And I'm saying, you know, do you think we should do something? Do you think we should do something? And he says, well, we already put the trade on. And I'm saying to him, no, I don't mean about the trade. Do you think we should do something about the collapse of society? And he goes, what can you do? There's nothing you can do. It's unstoppable. You know, all you can do is bet on it. I came out in 2014. I finally quit. And this is sort of basically the end of the book. And I decided to try and stop the collapse of the economy. And I think the only way to do that is to try and stop this extremely rapid growth in inequality. And I bounced around. I did a lot of things. I volunteered at a think tank called the New Economics Foundation here in London. I made a website, which is still up actually, called wealtheconomics.org, although we've bought garyseconomics.org for it now, just explaining really clearly how inequality hurts living standards. I went back to university. I did a 2-year master's at Oxford. I was there 2017 to 2019, where I basically tried to convince a bunch of super rich guys who literally wear bow ties and capes that inequality is bad, and they weren't. they weren't especially impressed. Basically, it was the beginning of COVID when I realized immediately inequality is going to explode. I decided, fuck it, we're going to have to go out and use the face and the name and the story. And I started writing about how I made tons of money, betting on the collapse of the economy and trying to build a public profile. Started a YouTube channel, which is, it's starting to get really popular now here in the UK. We got some viewers in the States as well. YouTube, TikTok, Twitter. And ultimately, the biggest thing which I've done is write this book and try and use the story.
Yeah.
To let people know what's happening. I think if people know what's happening, they won't accept it.
So the YouTube channel is called Gary's Economics, and it's about, I just watched a video about how you talked about why don't people spend more? It's because they don't have more money, and how rich mm-hmm. people spend a very small percentage of their income on necessities, where poor people spend 100% of their income on necessities. And that's a good thing to keep in mind. Let me ask you something, because I've been watching these. There's a lot of wealth tax proposals in state legislatures around the United States of America. How do you tax billionaires? How should you do it?
The first thing to say is there's kind of this myth going around, which is that billionaires are untaxable. And it's kind of based on this conceptualization of billionaires as kind of like magic Gandalf-like creatures that have this like massive...
I know a couple. They have horns and tails and...
massive bag of money that they can like teleport around. I think the best example of why you can tax billionaires is when Russia invaded Ukraine, suddenly the UK government decides, there's a lot of Russian billionaires that have their money here in the UK, and the mm-hmm. government suddenly decides, we want to tax those Russian billionaires. The best known of them is a guy called Roman Abramovich, who owns Chelsea Football Club, which is one of the biggest football clubs in London and in the country. And suddenly it turns out, whether Roman Abramovich leaves or not, what he owns is assets in the country, and they're taxable, and those cash flows can be frozen. And I think people need to understand, when I say tax the rich, I'm not talking about doctors, I'm not talking about lawyers, I'm not even talking about, heaven forbid, bankers. These guys can go overseas and work. I'm talking about families that own hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in assets. These guys own land, property, corporations, buildings, they own the government debt, they own personal debt. These guys can leave, but the assets remain. So they are very taxable. They are very taxable. But that doesn't completely answer your question. I think the one thing which I think is most important is whatever tax you bring in is absolutely essential that the richest cannot avoid it. Because I know ordinary middle-class people are worried, I'm going to say tax the rich. The rich are going to get loopholes put in it. The rich are going to avoid that. There was one case here in the UK where the government brought in a tax on people buying second homes. And I looked into the details. They put a loophole in there such that anyone buying seven or more at once didn't have to pay the tax.
Oh, man, I only bought six.
And then immediately after this came in, the Minister of Health, who is now the Chancellor, basically the Minister of the Economy, bought seven houses in one go. So I think people are right to be skeptical that the rich will avoid it. But if we don't tax the rich, these guys will eat us. They will eat everything, and we're seeing it. So we need to do it, and we need to make sure that the richest cannot avoid it.
And this is getting very tactical, but it's true, because we have income taxes in most places as opposed to even ad valorem taxes or spending taxes, right? And so the rich, basically, there seems to be two camps of trying to tax billionaires, and that's either like an Elizabeth Warren tax you 1.5% or something like that of your of your net worth every year. The other one is to have a one-time mark-to-market valuation on the value of your, well, it's generally entity, right? Because say you started a chain of gas stations 40 years ago and you've got $10 million of basis in it, but the thing's worth $100 million or whatever, just to make the math easy. So you're going to have a one-time $90 million gain. But then, I mean, that's kind of an accounting nightmare, first of all. But then there's also the, well, how do you know it's really worth that? And where's the guy going to come up with the cash to pay the tax? Like, and so there's really, there are practical issues about taxing billionaires that aren't supported by code in most places. What do you think about that?
I think the thing about they don't have the cash is really interesting, because the thing you need to understand about billionaires is they have an enormous amount of passive income. So if you have a wealth of even £1 billion, and a lot of billionaires have much more than that, if you have $1 billion, if you have $1 billion in wealth, you are going to have a passive income of something like $50 million a year. These guys are going to have a passive income of $1 million a week, right? If you had a passive income of $1 million a week, how much would you spend? Probably not $1 million a week, right?
I don't know, man. Yeah, probably not a million. Okay, 900 grand.
They will spend 100 grand a week. They'll use 900 grand a week to buy the rest of the assets. So there's this inbuilt structure, which is once you have the imbalance of power, these guys generate an enormous amount of income from the rest of us that they will use to buy the rest of the assets. So if you don't do anything about it, it becomes inevitable that over the next 10, 15, 20 years, the wealth of the middle class will be lost to the rich, because you cannot outcompete that kind of passive income. So even Warren's proposal of a 1.5 tax on wealth, all that would do is slow down the rate at which the billionaires eat the middle class. That is all it would do. And we're not going to get that. I think you need to deal with the fundamental problem of power imbalance. You know, if you look at the sort of the foundational ideas of the United States, they were obsessed with balance of power. They were obsessed with balance of power. You need to make sure that you have a variety of balances of power, because if you allow any one group to dominate power, then they will take control of society. And yet the US, perhaps more than any other Western country, has forgotten this. If you allow a group of individuals to dominate power, they will use that power to take the rest of the power. And you are seeing it now in the dispossession of the middle class and the dispossession of government. These guys are essentially an invading army. They are more powerful than you. The only thing you have to stop them is your power to tax them. If you do not tax them, simply from the force of their compound interest, they will take over your country. And it's not even because they're evil. It's not even because they're bad. They cannot help but do that. If you have that amount of wealth and that amount of passive income, the only thing you can do is buy the assets from the middle class and drive the government into debt. They don't have a choice. It's simply about understanding compound interest and power in our economy. If you do not tax them, they eat the middle class. And this is why most of human history is phenomenally high inequality. You need balances of power, and we are not, in any case, balancing the power of the billionaires.
All right. Well, if you want to hear more of Gary's thoughts, which are compellingly put forward on his YouTube channel, it's called Gary's Economics. And I definitely recommend you read his new book called The Trading Game, A Confession by Gary Stevenson. It's up there, man. It's up there with some great, you know, financial stories like Liar's Poker. And I love Douglas Brunt's Ghost of Manhattan and The Big Short, which you mentioned. What other Wall Street books have you modeled this after, do you think?
The one I really liked going into Wall Street was, have you ever read Reminiscences of a Stock Operator?
I don't know that I have.
It's from like the early 20th century. That is my favorite book about trading. But actually, when I was writing this book, I started rereading Liar's Poker, which I read back when I was like 21.
Sure.
And I thought, I don't want to do this. What I read instead was Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
Have you read that?
Yeah, of course.
Because I really wanted to do that kind of narrative, human character, driving narrative kind of style of book. And, you know, I think Kitchen Confidential is an amazing book. And I thought, a lot of Anthony Bourdain's work was great, but I would like to think I've captured a little bit of that driving, chaotic energy, and I hope the reader feels it when they read the book.
Right on. Well, best of luck, and hope it sells a whole bunch of copies, and thanks for your time, Gary. Oh, I should say Gaza. I wanted to say Gaza. I've been meaning to call you. Thanks for your time, brother.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
I enjoyed talking to Gary. I love the underdog character. I love the fact that here's this Cockney accent guy, makes tons of money on the big stage and proves to himself and to the world that he shouldn't be underestimated. And that was something that really resonated with me. Not that I have ever been really discriminated against in my life, but I do remember going to business school and being intimidated because I was from, at the time I was from, I came directly from Memphis, even though I grew up in Atlanta. I was going to school with a bunch of these Ivy League educated people who had lived in New York and Boston and were, they're just more worldly than I was, and I was a little intimidated. But they also, once in a while, would kind of, you know, listen to me talk and be like, oh, this guy's, maybe he's not that smart. And yeah, I did finish deep in the bottom 50th percentile, like probably 80th percentile of my class. So, I mean, when I say 80th percentile, I mean 20th percentile from a grade point average. But I'm a smart enough dude, even if I'm not the best student in the world. And I did like to see the kind of look in people's eyes when they realized I wasn't a complete brain dead hick. That was satisfying. So on some level, I can relate to Gary's being underestimated experience. Speaking of which, I think this speaks to the quality, the need for standardized testing. Now, as you all know, that standardized testing has taken a beating in America over the last few years because people believe it's prejudiced against certain groups. And that it is just one more thing that institutionalizes inequality and racial disparity and all that kind of stuff. And yet, in the past 6 to 9 months, several high-profile institutions have brought the SAT back. Why? Because it's a great way to identify talent outside of the prep school system. It's a great way to find poor kids of all races who are talented and who have every bit of the ability and the potential of other kids who are more in line to get into the big schools, having gone to better high schools, prep schools, et cetera. And I love the fact that it was an exam that helped Gary stand out and get to London School of Economics. So let's not just throw things away because some group out there is saying that it might promote inequality without any proof that it actually does. Speaking of inequality, well, let's talk first about his bonuses. Let's talk about those bonuses. Can you imagine being poor, living with your parents, you know, not even having a shower, not even having a desk in your house, and then getting a bonus for $750,000?
when you're 20, what do you say it was, 23 or 24? Can you imagine what that feels like? I remember, I was much older when I started making money, but I remember seeing my bank account rise in my early and mid 30s and feeling very, very proud and very empowered because I was actually escaping from the paycheck to paycheck way I was living up to that point in my adulthood. It's a very heady thing. There's a comedian, Matthew Broussard, who said if he ever made $1 million, he would just print out a statement and staple it to the wall and look at it all the time. There is a little bit of that, and it sounds like Gary did some of that too, but it takes some getting used to. And as he says, like the stress of having it and then going like, oh, I better not screw this up, is something that we should be, or the having of it is something we should be very excited about, very proud of, very joyful about, and yet it brings its own set of stresses and necessary work. I've spent a lot of time in the last few months working on money management and estates and trusts and all this kind of stuff. And it's a great, great privilege to have to do that. But it is time consuming and it's something you have to learn how to deal with. So good things can also come with responsibilities as well as privileges. All right, lastly, inequality. Okay, look, inequality is an issue. And the question isn't whether it is or whether it isn't. It is an issue. The question is, how do you deal with it? What do you do with it? Because a lot of the issues in this world, I lived in California, okay? We had a $1 million, 1,500 square foot house. And we'd wake up and there'd be homeless people sleeping in the front yard. I am of the opinion that you could charge 10 times the amount of taxes above what California's already egregiously high taxes are, and you still wouldn't solve the homelessness problem in California. At a certain point, it's not about money. It's about political will. It's about people who actually want to solve problems instead of to perpetuate them. You know, look, billionaires know how to make money. The people who run for office don't. They're not the most fiscally responsible people in the world. They're beholden to all sorts of constituencies that have no desire in solving problems. They just want more money going towards their priorities, whatever they are. If you're Bill Gates, why does Bill Gates start the Gates Foundation instead of just giving hundreds of billions of dollars to the U.S. government? Isn't that what he should do? Isn't the patriotic thing to do to just give your money to the government? Well, no, it's not. Because Bill Gates is 100 times smarter than the governor of Washington, than the state legislatures who are making Washington state tax policy. And he knows that if he uses his money wisely, he can do things like cure malaria. He can do things like create better toilets for Africa, create better access to drinking water. He's looking at solving big, big problems as opposed to viewing the world through the lens of your congressional district or your state or even the United States of America. Do you trust Joe Biden or Donald Trump to invest your money wisely? I don't. Maybe the issue isn't a matter of generosity or of billionaires paying their fair share. Maybe it's a matter of them wanting money to be used with respect, them wanting their money that they've worked very, very hard to earn to be used to solve real problems, as opposed to be thrown at one political initiative or another. So yeah, I agree with Gary in the sense that inequality is a problem, but I don't believe that the way out is by taxing people to death and then just throwing money at the current initiatives that governments throw money at. I'm happy to be disagreed with. Send me your notes. You do. Paul@crazymoneypodcast.com. Post it in the unofficial Paul Ellinger Facebook page. Post it on Instagram. Do what you will, sir or ma'am. I'm happy to be disagreed with. We're grownups. We're here because we want to wrestle with issues. These are just my thoughts. These are the way I feel about things. I'm happy to be wrong. I've been wrong before. I'll be wrong again. But I'm pretty sure I'm not wrong. I know what I will be. I'll be back next week with Sharon McMahon. Who is she? She is America's nonpartisan political teacher. She's the one that wants to help make you smarter about the way government works so that you can make better decisions when you go into the voting booth. And I hope you do. Sharon McMahon next week on Crazy Money. Until then, Mike Carano, make me sound smart.